Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelow. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. And good morning. We continue on the South Shore's Morning News on WATD. I'm Rob Hackelow with the morning team. In this segment, we're going to be talking about exploring the United States through your taste buds with the ultimate foodcation bucket list. We've got a great book out from National Geographic. It's called 50 States, 1,000 Eats, Where to Go, When to Go, What to Eat, What to Drink, and we're going to dive into it all. And joining us now, we have editor, writer, photographer, and speaker Joe Yergist, who joins us now. Joe, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Great to have you here on WATD, and what a fun assignment. Tell me more about how you got involved in this project and how excited you were to kind of dive in and explore this great country of ours through food.
Well, it's the seventh in a series of books that I've done for National Geographic that started in 2017 with the original 50 States book. And I was lucky enough and fortunate enough that that became kind of an overnight bestseller and has sold something like 500,000 copies since it first came out. And I think it surprised the editors at National Geographic, too. And they said, okay, well, that was people like that one, so let's do some more. So we've done road trips and national parks and hiking trails and camping. And then they said, well, why not food? Americans like to eat. Let's do food. So that's how I got around to doing the food book.
Well, tell me about how the process worked out, because there are 50 states and also included, we should mention, favorite places to go in Canada as well. This is a great book. So break it down, Joe. Were you able to, I mean, you can't try everything, but were you able to get and sample some of these great items that you mentioned in the book?
Yeah, I try to go to as many places as possible. I had a year to write this book, and I made some special trips to different places that I didn't know that well, just for the food. But it's really an accumulation of food that I've eaten or places over my whole lifetime. But also going back to 2016, when I was doing trips to research the original 50 States book. Each of these books required multiple trips, and, you know, you got to eat somewhere. And so it's an accumulation, really. And then the editors at National Geographic weighed in with a lot of their favorite places from their hometowns and their home states. And, of course, I'm asking family and friends in different places. And so it's, you know, like I would like to take credit for eating it all 1,000 places, but it's really a team effort.
Yeah. Well, tell me about some of your favorites in the time that we have you, Joe, of maybe some places, because so many people want to do road trips. I'm approaching a 50th birthday. A couple of my guy friends want to do part of Route 66. So I'm excited to explore the country because I really haven't explored much out of the East Coast. So tell me about some favorites anywhere in the book here. Tell us a few of the treats that you would like to share.
Well, if you're really interested in an unusual road trip, and you like variations on Mexican food, I would do a Southwest road trip, because the four states that border Mexico have very different types of Mexican food. And I would start in San Antonio, then I would go to Santa Fe, then I would go to Tucson, and then I would go to San Diego. And you will find different variations of Mexican food, all of them delicious, in all four of those cities.
Wow,
so that's one I would definitely recommend.
Yeah. How about another?
You know, just about any kind of road trip across the South.
Yeah.
I would start with barbecue in North Carolina.
Oh.
Go to low country cooking in Savannah and Charleston. Head over to, Georgia and Alabama for kind of soul food and fried chicken, and then down to New Orleans for Creole and Cajun food. So a nice southern road trip that goes from North Carolina to New Orleans as well. Another I'd recommend.
Mm. And we should mention the book is filled with amazing photos. It's a National Geographic book, after all. And Massachusetts has just got a place in here, just like every other state. And you talk about seafood and baked beans and
I mean, the home to Dunkin' Donuts and other interesting places. And cranberries. We love cranberries, too, here in Massachusetts. Yes. So it really is a lot of fun. Joe, tell me about what's so amazing. I guess, you know, in taking road trip, that's what's great about this country is there's so many different places, so many different cultures. But it really is fun to kind of get off the beaten path and maybe, I mean, nothing wrong with major chains, but it's really nice in this book as you talk about with the different local places to find, right?
Yeah. From the very start, we wanted to feature some of the Michelin, you know, three-star places, but we also wanted to look for mom-and-pop restaurants and roadside diners and little hole-in-the-wall places where you often find incredible food.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love this. People can get this, by the way. There's not only about places to visit, but also you've got histories behind some of the places and the ingredients, and also advice as well. So this would be a fun book to pick up as you're making that road trip. And also in here, we should mention, we've got the 50 states, but you've got Canada in here as well, right?
Yeah, we have all the Canadian provinces and Yukon, the Yukon Territory.
Wow. I'll tell you, there's so many wonderful places to visit. Where would you like to get next, Joe?
In terms of eating or just generally speaking?
Just general. Is there anything else you'd want to visit, maybe, after working on this book that you haven't gotten to yet?
I am going to the Canadian Arctic in September.
Oh, wow.
I have never been up to the Northwest Passage. I'm going in late September because that's when the ice flow is the least and you can get around by boat the most. So that's kind of been on my bucket list for a long time, and I've never managed to make it up there. Not for the food so much, but just for the landscapes and the wildlife.
Yeah.
So that's definitely on my bucket list. And, you know, I've covered so much of the U.S. and Canada over the past couple of years that I don't know if there's any bucket list places left here. There's things I want to do. I'd love to go whitewater rafting in West Virginia, for instance, which I've never done, even though I've been to West Virginia a couple times. And there are places I never get tired of going back to, but I tend to go to them in the off-season now, like Yosemite and Yellowstone National Parks. I would never go in the summer now, but the early spring and the late fall and even the middle of winter in these places are incredible.
Wow.
I've spent a lot of time in New England because both of my kids went to college there.
Oh, well, we appreciate that. Yeah, it's a great place for colleges, that's for sure. Well, Discover the Great Country, 50 States, 1,000 Eats. It's the new book out, and we've been chatting this morning with legendary editor, writer, photographer, and speaker, Joe Yorgerst. Joe, thank you.
Thanks for having me, and have a good one.
You too, Joe. The South Shore's Morning News coming to you from Broadcast House in Marshfield. I am Rob Hakala. Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS national correspondent. He is author of a new book that just came out. It's available now everywhere. It's called Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here on WATD. Well, Jonathan, first of all, you're an award-winning reporter. Your travels have taken you around this great country and around the world. So tell me why you decided first to focus with your book on climate change and specifically small-town America.
Yeah, you know, as a journalist, I've always found storytelling to be a powerful tool to understand how the world works. And for me, as a journalist at CBS News, and even before that, I've pinballed across the country covering extreme weather event after extreme weather event, and it's been a priceless education where I've been able to see in real time from these front lines the impacts climate change is having on radicalizing our weather and the impact this radicalized weather is having on small town America and big town America as well. And it was my hope when writing this book, I could take readers onto these front lines with me so that they too could connect these dots. I focus on small town America because these are communities that don't have the infrastructure, the engineering, the budget to protect themselves against our radicalized weather. I call them canaries in the coal mine for what could come to bigger cities as Mother Nature outpaces our modern tools to hold us back. And we've already seen this happen in big cities as well. I'm thinking Superstorm Sandy, which I covered when I was working in New York, and the impact it had on New York City, taking it offline in some cases for weeks, months, and years. And I think if we listen and take a closer look at what's happening in our small towns, we can see the warning signs and take action to build more resilient communities before the next storm hits.
Yeah, and one of the big events is you open the book talking about the tragic events in Hawaii, and that was a story, I think, for most of us, we were thinking, how could this happen? And you say that actually there were people warning about this, that there were some warning signs, right? Tell us about that.
What happened in Lahaina should serve as, unfortunately, a lesson for us all. We were one of the first network crews to arrive in what was left of downtown Lahaina. 80% of that community was destroyed. And what we heard time and time again following this disaster from local leaders describing this fire as an explosion. They said it was like a bomb going off, implying there was no time to take action. But as we soon learned and would report, nearly 9 years before, in 2014, scientists on the island came out with a report warning that climate change was making the community threatened by and more vulnerable to wildfires. They prescribed treatments, things that could be done to protect the community, including removing dry invasive grasses that had taken root, restoring wetlands and conserving water, and rebuilding with fire-resistant materials and upgrading homes with these materials, which qualified for tax credits. But this report was essentially filed away and ignored. Action wasn't taken in time. And those warnings, unheeded, became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the question that I asked when I was there reporting and wondering as I was walking through mile after mile of devastation came from a home that was still standing unscathed, what is known today as the house with the red roof locally in that community. If this home had been purchased by homeowners that had made some of those upgrades and implemented those scientific remedies, specifically to prevent termite infestation, but all of the changes were the same kinds of changes you would use to protect a community from wildfire. And so this home took action, even when leaders didn't, and it survived. So what happens if we have more homes with red roofs across the country? We have more resilient communities as a result.
Wow, that's amazing. So that house survived, and that was a lesson. And you talked about, really, with much of this, that there are warning signs. There are things that we can do sooner than later, right?
That's true. So there's two kinds of changes that I focus on in the book. One is climate change, which most of us are familiar with, our use of fossil fuels, releasing more greenhouse gas emissions, which warm our climate. And it's important that we address this, and we are making significant gains in this country and across the world, but it does involve the entire global community to come together and act as one. But even if we reduced all of those emissions today, it would take decades, according to scientists, to see a positive impact in our weather. In the meantime, there's this other change. It's habitat change. Restoring our habitats back to a more natural state, building in safer places, in safer ways, restoring our wetlands and our natural habitats. And if we choose to do so, and we can, we all have that individual power as residents, as homeowners, and as individual communities. The point I make, and I think this is a point of hope, we do have power as long as we're empowered with the information and the tools to take action.
What about the people, Jonathan? I suppose the argument is always about cost of making changes and making improvements, although I can't help but think about the cost from cleaning up from these storms and the cost of human life. But that's an argument I often hear, is about it's too expensive to make changes.
And it's a fair argument. It is expensive, but there is money out there, and there are federal programs. But unfortunately, it's difficult for many people to figure out how to cut through the bureaucratic red tape, how to gain access to the information and the funding that is available. You know, there's the Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure deal. Both have infused more than $1 billion to fight both climate change and habitat change. And there are resources to residents and to local leaders to tap into this and to get money to help with those restoration efforts. There's a great website. It's put out by the government. It's called toolkit.climate.gov. And if you go there, and anybody can do this, and it's critical that local leaders do this to make sure that they have access in this database put up through the government to tap into those funds, to find out what qualifies for restoration, and to implement that money as quickly as possible. It's there, but it only matters if it's being used.
Before It's Gone, Stories from the Front Lines of Climate Change in Small Town America, by award-winning reporter from CBS, Jonathan Vigliotti. The book is now available in stores and online. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Thank you for having me, Marv. I really appreciate it.
The South Shore's Morning News continues. Great to have you here. And every week at this time, we check in with our tech guy, David Snell joins us from Act Smart IT in Wareham. David, good morning.
And good morning to you, Rob.
Good morning. We've got another data breach to be aware of, and this one involving one of the big cell phone. Well, in addition, they do a whole bunch, right? This is AT&T.
They do a whole bunch. And the problem with this data breach is it is not happening right now. It happened 3 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So, but the thing about that is the cyber criminal who stole the data from AT&T, and by the way, AT&T still doesn't admit that they stole it from them.
Oh.
But whoever stole the data just released it on the dark web last week.
Boy, what were they really playing the long game, David? Do they usually hold on to data this long?
Yeah, in many cases they do, because what happens is, and we human beings do this all the time, we forget about things like this. So we don't worry too much about it until something like this comes back up and smacks us in the head.
Okay.
So what's happening, 73 million current and former being the operative word here, customers of AT&T, their data has been released. The data includes names, home addresses, phone numbers, social security numbers, and dates of birth. Everything a cyber criminal wants.
Oh, boy. Wow. A treasure trove of data. So they got this. And as you said, this could be, since it's years ago, I imagine people nowadays sometimes switch their carriers around. I feel like more often than they used to get different deals. So even if you're listening today and you say, well, you know, I'm a T-Mobile person or Verizon, I don't have to worry about this. You might not if you maybe had an AT&T plan in the past, right?
That's right. If you've ever subscribed to AT&T prior to 2021, when this breach occurred, your data is now in the hands of cyber criminals and for sale on the dark web. So that means 65.4 million former account holders out of the 7.6 million current account holders that were actually affected by this. So if you were a former account holder of AT&T, there's some things that you really should consider doing immediately, because this is going around now very quickly. And we've seen it on the news. I'm sure you got it on the AP Wire too, Rob.
Yeah, I did see AT&T huge data breach, and I kind of got that alert, I think, over the weekend. So,
yeah.
So what are those things that we should be thinking about or doing right away?
Well, the first thing everyone should do if they've ever had an AT&T account with a password is if you don't have AT&T, it doesn't matter, but if you ever use that password elsewhere from the same password you use on AT&T, you need to change it. And many people back 3 years ago didn't think much about reusing passwords. They just made it easy for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have that password anywhere right now that's in use, and the hackers can kind of work towards finding you and getting into your accounts. The problem really is, though, they can assume your identity. They can take out loans in your name. They can open bank accounts, all sorts of things, because they have all that information about us.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. So we start with the passwords. So we start there and change those.
Change
whatever you have, because you may have use that same password, chances are, in some other sensitive accounts. So change that password for the AT&T. Okay, what else do we need to do?
And the final thing, we talk about this all the time, is there's so much personal information out there about us. Everyone should consider freezing their credit.
Okay.
Okay, it's a hassle, but I feel it's a necessary step. So once you've frozen your credit, no new accounts can be opened in your name.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay. So, yeah, no new accounts, because that's the thing that's going to be happening if we don't freeze it and we're not paying attention.
Correct. Identity theft, cyber criminals, even filing your taxes for you and getting your refund before you even filed your own taxes.
It's very nice to file the taxes for me and take the refund. Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you need to think about anything that they could do with your data. So it's very simple to freeze your credit. There's, in the article we have on the web, there's three main credit bureaus. You got Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion.
Mm-hmm.
You can do all of this online in a matter of minutes, and it just freezes your credit, so no one can open an account for you. But the hassle about it is that you will not be able to open another account without unfreezing it. So, for instance, if you go to open up, someone offers you at the register a new account, and you try to open it, it's not going to be open to you because you have it frozen. But that's a good thing. Even though it's a little more of a hassle and one more step for you, this is the way. This is really the only way to protect yourself with this data breach.
All right, and this is a really large data breach, personal information, social security numbers. As you mentioned, it's now on the dark web. And so AT&T, I mean, this has been in the news, and you're saying they haven't really talked about it at all. It's a big story, and they haven't said much.
Well, they've talked about it, and they said that they didn't believe that the data came from their servers. But then Troy Hunt, who is the owner of Have I Been Pawned, we've talked about that website quite often, he got some of the data. He checked it with AT&T customers whose data was there, so they verified that it was, in many cases, the only password and username they use for AT&T, so they know that that's where it came from.
Okay. All right. So, but they haven't really gotten more into, at least on the AT&T side, saying, you know, how did this happen, or we fixed whatever it was. They still don't want to touch upon that.
Exactly. But what they did do as of yesterday is they mentioned that they notified on their website that they are going to be resetting the passwords of existing customers. That makes no difference to past customers. We had to take an action on this ourselves.
All right. AT&T, we take cybersecurity very seriously, and privacy is a fundamental commitment at AT&T. And how do you fill out your bracket? Okay, that's, I guess, what they're writing on their social media. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, not much there, but as David mentioned, change the password first and start there, and keep an eye on the credit as well. And David, people can read the blog, as we've got, again, just another one. We've discussed these data breach to be aware of. David, where can people go to read more?
People should go to Act Smart IT, click on my blog link, and you get all the links to all the places you need to go and fix your stuff.
David Snell at Act Smart IT in Wareham. Act Smart IT in Wareham. Thank you, David.
Have a good day, Rob.
You too. That's ActSmartIT.com. Peter Forman. Peter is the president and CEO, and Peter joins us. Peter, good morning.
Good morning, Rob. The healthcare business sector is one of the largest and most robust business sectors on the South Shore, one of our largest employers, and of course provides incredible services that make the South Shore a great place to live. But the health systems are under pressure. So we're going to take a look this morning with a great panel, Paul Casale of Welch Senior Living, Rich Fernandes, president of BID Milton, Renee McGinnis, the president of NDNA and Hospice, and my guest this morning, Dr. Alan Smith, who is president of South Shore Health. And we're going to look a little bit under the covers of the health system and some of the stress points.
Oh, wow.
So let me introduce Alan, who's been a guest on our show before.
Yes, we have Dr. Alan Smith. Welcome back to the broadcast. Good to have you on the program again.
Thank you for inviting me, Rob and Peter, and I appreciate being here, and I enjoyed my last time with you as well.
Well, we are glad to have you back, and this is an important topic for sure. So, Alan, why don't you fill us in first and talk about the state of healthcare, specifically on the South Shore. What is the state currently?
Well, I think, Rob, you can look at it in two levels. One, I think we have a wonderful group of healthcare providers on the South Shore. I think we're very blessed here with the quality of care that's provided, whether you're talking primary care or specialists, hospitals, VNAs, whether you're talking home care or hospices or skilled nursing facilities. So on the one hand, we're very blessed. On the other, we're struggling because it's very, very busy and very, very crowded. Some of that is sort of state and national issues, but the local issues really are the closures of several hospitals over the years. So first Quincy Hospital, mm-hmm. then the Quincy ED and Norwood Hospitals in 2020, Compass Medical closing, and then lastly, when Signature Brockton Hospital closed due to the electrical fire on February 7th, 2023. So all of those closed hospitals has meant that every other facility is extra overloaded right now.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the stories we're hearing are about emergency departments backed up. Tell us, you know, maybe it has to do with some of the reasons you mentioned, but maybe you can fill us in on the details when there seem to be so many new options for quick care. I mean, all these different, you know, health places that we have to go to now, we didn't have these growing up as much about going to these non-hospital settings instead of emergency rooms. Why are we still seeing the crowds and the conditions?
That's a great question, Rob. So, you know, you can look at emergency room visits on different levels, and some are ones where it would be appropriate, as you say, for a patient to be seen, whether in their primary care or specialist office or urgent care. And there's lots and lots of urgent cares, as you're right, that have sprung up. And what we're seeing is actually the percentage of the visits we're getting that are of that level are below the national average. So while you always would like to encourage people to seek alternatives, and many of them do, it's really a small part of the problem. The real problem is really, really sick people coming by ambulance. For example, we used to get 100 ambulances a day at South Shore Hospital. Now we're 120, sometimes 150 ambulances a day. And those people are really sick and need attention and often get admitted. And what we're dealing with then is just not enough space. We have a 74-bed emergency department, and we're trying to expand it. We added 10 beds. We hope to add another 10 more. But you're fundamentally just the rapid change in the volumes, particularly with these hospital closures, has really caused a significant impact.
Well, the volume. Is it also, Alan, does it have anything with us as a population getting older? Is that possible, that why we're seeing more ambulance visits? Or
can we be in denial about getting older? Does that work? yes, no question that aging is an issue, but we're seeing a lot of younger people too, a lot of behavioral health as well.
Okay.
And what happens is it then backs up in the waiting room, and we apologize for that. I was rounding last evening, and we were pretty full, and people understandably want to be seen right away. I think the public has been remarkably patient, but this is tough to wait. And then sometimes they get admitted and they need to wait in our ED, sometimes in the hallway for several hours or even overnight until a bed opens up upstairs, because we're all constrained for those resources and beds and staff. But it's tough on the patients and families, and we recognize that.
Well, let's, I guess, in relation, if we can compare it to the body, when one part of the body, what happens when one part of the health system is under stress? How does that affect other parts of the system as a whole?
That's a great question, Rob. So, I've been in healthcare a long time, and I think as an industry, we have kind of worked in parallel with other parts. So whether it's primary care to specialists or doctors to hospitals or with VNAs and skilled nursing, and we've all kind of gotten along and tried to work together. But we haven't really thought of ourselves as one system, one ecosystem. And I think COVID really, really unmasked that in a significant and a very difficult way, when we couldn't get people into skilled nursing facilities because they had to test for COVID and they didn't have enough staff, and VNAs were short staffed. And to this day, we're still dealing with those effects. So we're really having an impact all over, similar with primary care. So I think really as an industry, and this is where I think the South Shore has an opportunity to be a leader, both locally and nationally, in coming together and working as a team. And that's part of what this panel is about today, Rob.
Yeah. We got some really great individuals and good team members. And you talk about team. Well, is stress on parts of the system, is this a temporary or short-term problem, Alan, or are we facing some long-term challenges to healthcare here in the South Shore?
It's always tough to predict, but I think we should assume that much of this is long-term, particularly the labor shortages, and how do we do that? And again, I also want to put a plug in for the Chamber and Peter Foreman's leadership, because I think this is a place where if we can come together and look at issues like demographics and labor and how we address those, because demographics are coming, as you said, the aging is coming, so that's predictable. So if we can work together, and I think a place like the Chamber, frankly, allows what are legally considered competitors to actually collaborate in a way that's good for this community.
Dr. Alan Smith, appreciate your perspective and your unique insight
Dr. Alan Smith is president of South Shore Health, southshorehealth.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM, mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 959watd.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 959watd.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.